Stripe is the go-to choice for AI companies, from early-stage startups to scaled enterprises. 78% of the leading AI companies use Stripe to go to market quickly and scale globally. That includes pioneers like NVIDIA, OpenAI, and Perplexity. Stripe has developed cutting-edge tools to improve everything from fraud detection to checkout optimization. Whether you're aiming for incremental gains or planning for enterprise transformation, see how Stripe can help at stripe.com.
The sales are sizzling at Whole Foods Market just in time for the 4th of July weekend. Fire up the grill with savings on robust no antibiotics ever steaks. And there's more. Look for sales on meaty pork chops, made-in-house salmon burgers, and sustainable wild-caught sockeye salmon fillets. Get it all with same-day delivery or free pickup. Restrictions apply. Shop everything you need for 4th of July and beyond at Whole Foods Market, in-store and online.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So we have lots in store for today's show. The OECD has cut its global forecast and it was the headline that screamed from the Financial Times earlier on this week. So we are going to be joined by the OECD economist Isabel Kosk to delve deeper into these latest results and particularly look at what this means for things closer to home. And as record numbers of students begin their leaving and junior cert exams, we'll question whether or not our economics curriculum through school and college is adequately preparing our graduates for a changing world of work. And I have a particular take on that. So make sure and stay with us for that conversation. And also, Ireland has the lowest rate of employment for people with disabilities in the EU. We're going to hear from Elaine Teague, CEO of Disability Federation of Ireland, and Bobby Hickey, who works in the diversity and inclusion space, who is blind and is joining to tell us her story. Now, as ever, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on LinkedIn, Facebook, X and Blue Sky at Susan Hayes Cullerton. And I have to tell you some of the things that you've been telling me over the past while. So first up, we had a message in here from Jackie and it particularly followed up on the conversation that we had with Lee from New Zealand a couple of weeks ago about taking money out of your pension to buy your first house. And Jackie told us that this reminded her to do something about her Kiwi saver and thanked us very much for the prompt. Secondly, I'll tell you this much. If you are ever wondering about how to get a conversation started, bring up Ozempic. The reaction to what people said last week around Ozempic, the conversation that we had with Ben Spencer around this, everyone has an opinion on this. And it's really interesting to hear it from various different perspectives, but that one certainly has got a reaction. And the last one I wanted to mention is that Alison sent in a lovely message and she just said that the show is entertaining, interesting and educational. And particularly the reason I'm sharing that with you that week is that's exactly what we hope this show is. So thank you so much indeed, Alison, for sharing that with me. So I'm going to start off this week with talking about consumer surplus. I went into a shoe shop in Bandon recently and I saw a pair of shoes there for €50 and thought they're worth a lot more than that. And that's exactly what consumer surplus, the economic concept is. It's when the consumer, like me, sees something where the price is lower than what they're willing to pay. And the reason this is a useful concept is it helps households work out value for money and where they're going to spend their money. And then, of course, on the other hand, it's also useful then for businesses when they're setting prices and particularly around a time that they would be putting sales on, etc. So that's what I want to start off with this week, with the consumer surplus and how I'm really enjoying those shoes. Well, earlier this week, the OECD announced that it is cutting its annual global forecast. And after 3.3% growth last year, the world economy is now expected to expand by what's being described as a modest 2.9% in 2025 and 2026, which is lower than what was expected back in March. So what has changed and how much of this is down to Trump economics? So Isabel Kosk is Deputy Director of Country Studies with the OECD Economics Department. She's joining us from Paris this morning. First of all, Isabel, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Well, thank you. Thank you much for having me. Well, indeed, we downgraded our forecasts in our recent economic outlook for almost all the economies we cover. That's related to substantial increases in trade barriers, but also heightened policy uncertainty, especially with respect to trade policy, but also tighter financial conditions and weaker business and consumer confidence.
Okay. And Isabel, I'm going to delve into each part of that. But first of all, if we take a look at the overall global picture, obviously, the report says, in general, the expectation is for economic growth to fall. Well, sorry, to lessen. But we have a weaker dollar since the beginning of the year, so that is good for US exports, and it's cheaper, say, for you and me to buy from there. The cost of oil has fallen, again, since the beginning of the year. Governments are spending more money fiscally in the US, here in the EU and in China, and we have falling interest rates, as we saw again this week in Europe. So are we overestimating the impact that the tariffs and the policy uncertainty could really have?
Well, I mean, the slowdown that we project is concentrated in the US, Canada and Mexico, the countries that are obviously mostly affected by the tariffs, while for China and also for other economies, we see smaller downgrades. You're right, in some countries, there are actually fiscal packages being launched, notably in China and in Germany. And in these countries, indeed, fiscal support is supporting economic growth going forward in our projection.
Now, Germany, I definitely want to zone in on there for a moment, because this seems to be a really, really, really big change. And just to bring our listeners up to date, in case that they're not aware, and this specifically you refer to in the, or the report refers to in the German chapter. So from managing the budget really carefully, there's now additional spending exceeding 1% of GDP on defence, a 500 billion special fund for additional investment in infrastructure and green transformation. And there's more for sub-national governments and more again for local public investment. So obviously Germany will need to borrow to fund a lot of this. And it does change the game really in the countrywide economy and further afield then across the EU. What do you think the real impact of that is going to be over the coming years? Is it a big game changer?
Well, we think really that it has the potential to be a big game changer. We expect Germany to only grow by 0.4% in 2025, but then by 1.2% next year, because obviously all this investment spending needs some time, you know, to be implemented. It will have also some spillovers on neighboring countries because the German economy is obviously closely connected to other countries in Europe. So we also expect some positive impetus from this on Europe more widely. Obviously, the impact will also very much depend on the extent to which this increased public spending will be able to crowd in more private investment, because private investment in Germany has been low for many years. And for this to happen, these fiscal reforms now need to be complemented by important structural reforms, like reducing the administrative burden on firms, making regulation more competition friendly, solving the labor market shortages that the economy is facing, so that also private firms are really willing to invest again in the economy.
I think there's a couple of things there, particularly that you've said around the lack of private investment. And you can see that on the ground in certainly when you're driving along the Autobahn or places like that. But the other thing that you mentioned there is about the labour market. Now, if we look at the expansion of the labour market in Europe over the past couple of decades, it has been fueled by inward migration. It has been fueled by greater education. It has been fueled by more women joining the workplace, etc. What do you see that the European Union and the countries that comprise it, how do you see those labour market shortages being resolved?
Well, there is still room in many countries to actually even better integrate some of the groups you've mentioned in the labour markets. A lot of efforts have been made to better integrate women through better childcare and so on. But several countries still have a lot of potential to do better there, including Germany, but also Austria, the Netherlands, you know, where women either don't participate at all in the labour market or still work part-time a lot. Also, the elderly, that's a group that needs to be better integrated. What we recommend countries is, first of all, to extend working lives, for instance, through pension reform, phasing out early retirement options, but then also to make sure that these older workers, you know, still have skills that are up to date, especially digital skills, for instance, are very much demanded in the labour market. So making sure that adult training programs equip these people with necessary skills to be successful in the labour market, that's really important. And there's also still room to better integrate immigrants in the labour market, because often, even though they may have a job, they are overqualified for their job because their qualifications, often obtained in a foreign country, are not recognised by domestic firms. So putting systems in place, for instance, to better recognise foreign qualifications can really help.
There's a lot in that for sure. And particularly the point about lifelong learning and the maintaining one's skills as you go through life and go through your career. And of course, what's a great thing in Europe is that we're having longer lives. Can I now turn to inflation? I just want to particularly double down on the area that you mentioned there at the beginning of the interview around where the report highlights the greatest risk, which is particularly the US and then, as you said, Canada and Mexico. But let me just stay with the US for the moment. So in the report, and it's roundabout, you know, it's, I, by the way, I highly recommend the 280 pages to our listeners. It's a superb piece of reading, I have to say. But you paint a very clear picture, and I haven't seen it painted as clearly as this in other places, where you said in the US, about 10% of the consumer basket is imported. And then you said if the 60% tariff increase in China and the 10% in the rest of the world was to be passed through, it would mean a 1.4% increase for the consumer. So Isabel, what's the big problem then?
Well, we still expect inflation in the US to rise this year as a result of the tariffs. We expect actually annual inflation to go up to almost 4% by the end of this year.
And where's the gap then between the 1.4% that would be passed on to the consumer and broader inflation up to 4%?
Well, obviously, there's import prices are going up to some extent, right? But obviously, you also have domestic developments that are happening. I mean, we're seeing inflation expectations having risen, for instance, in the United States. We also see that the labor market is still very tight. And of course, this all also implies, you know, say puts upside pressure on inflation. And for this reason, we also expect actually the Fed to maintain the policy rate on hold for at least until the end of the year. Next year, you know, when growth will moderate, the labor market will weaken. This is when we also expect then inflation to slowly come down again.
And, you know, as I've looked at the conversation around US interest rates this week, obviously the president has said that they should be falling. The stock market is baking in a rate cut possibly in September. It'll be interesting just to see how that develops. But there was another thing that pointed that came up in the report again and again and again in around about the first 60 pages. Over and over again, you've repeated the point. Is there a risk that we're being far too complacent about the impact of these being felt? Because when we look at inflation figures and other things, basically the impact of tariffs, etc., aren't necessarily being felt because our people and businesses buy more things than they need. Buy more things than they need before the really high tariffs kick in. So is it the fact that there's a lot of inventory being bought, that there's inventory is being stored, and that they, because of all of this, we're not seeing the impacts of what you're predicting are happening sooner?
Well, we saw, for instance, that in many countries, the first quarter of this year, when we look at production, at growth numbers, the first quarter was quite strong. And we believe that this was partly linked to some front loading. So with firms, you know, purchasing things ahead of some tariffs being imposed. There's probably also something else that was going on in some countries, but nonetheless, we clearly see this front loading. This is also why we do not expect this strength with which we started into the year to continue going forward. But we now expect some weakening of growth because, yeah, the front loading happened and now actually there, you know, there's less need for firms to do stockpiling to build up their inventories.
Well, I want to bring this conversation a bit closer to home because as I was reading the advice you have for governments, it was to establish a credible fiscal path to debt sustainability and maintain the ability to react to future shocks. Now, just for listeners who may not be familiar with that language, my understanding of that is that we should be taxing more, spending less, just to make sure that we can maintain and repay the debt that we have, and also to be able to react to future things if things go wrong by then being able to borrow more if we need to. However, when I read that first, I thought that was a very direct message to the White House in the week that we've been talking about the big, beautiful tax bill. However, when I looked at the Irish chapter of the report, I saw that it's actually aimed very much at us here in Ireland. When you say looking risks, looming risks warrant greater financial prudence. What's your take on the Irish economy at the moment?
Well, in terms of fiscal policy, obviously Ireland is benefiting from very high tax revenues. And while tariffs could lower corporate and personal income tax revenues, we still believe that any excess corporate tax receipts should continue to be allocated to long-term saving funds that have been established. This seems, in our view, the right strategy in light, indeed, of looming fiscal pressures that are linked to population aging, to the green transition, and also to digitalization. So we think this would be a prudent approach, which This does not say that there is no need in Ireland to also increase spending in some areas. For instance, Ireland has an important investment backlog in certain infrastructures such as housing, transport, energy, and that's actually hampering further progress in living standards, but also actually weighs on foreign investor confidence. So productive investment in this area is key, but we think this investment needs to happen at a gradual pace, yeah, because there are capacity constraints in the construction industry. And if you go too fast, this then obviously just leads to higher prices. But nonetheless, even though we want higher spending in these areas, we also see that there is potential in Ireland to find, say, room for reducing spending inefficiencies in other areas. So some comprehensive spending reviews could help you identify room. For instance, to areas where we point out is the cost of living initiative, where we see that many of the measures are loosely targeted or too loosely targeted, and could definitely be better, you know, focus on those really in need. And another area for Ireland where we think there are rooms for efficiency improvements is healthcare, as this is a sector where there were important cost overruns over the last years. So there's clearly room for some efficiency improvements.
Now, both of those measures that you particularly spoke about, more such was the latter part of your answer on the cost of living and healthcare, highly contentious points, all right, and ones that have been discussed at large. I mean, the cost of living particularly, I think that was so high for a very, very, while it was a concentrated, a relatively short period of time, the government needed to get in there and do something fast. And I think that was, to a large degree, thinking back on the political commentary around it at the time, is that everybody needed help at the time, or at least the speed to getting things out to people needed to be a lot faster than the targeting. So that's interesting that you've pointed that out. And healthcare, it's a big one. It certainly is a big one, Isabel. But can I go, and I just want to finish up around investment, because in the special chapter in the report, it was dedicated to improving European competitiveness. Now, when I opened up that chapter, I was expecting like a summarised version of Draghi's report and around the, you know, economic community across Europe. Everyone is talking about that. But I was surprised to see about 10 pages dedicated to figuring out why businesses in Europe have let an investment gap emerge, particularly in comparison to the US and more recently China. I'm paraphrasing the report now, but European businesses have had the money, have had the incentives, have had the prospects of generating returns, have been supported by an entrepreneurial ecosystem, and while not a fiscal EU budget, a broader European Union budget. So what has been holding European businesses back from investing more?
Well, one reason that we identify in the report as probably being a major driver is increased uncertainty. Basically, since the global financial crisis, if you look at various measures of uncertainty, it has clearly increased. And we think that this is one reason why investment was held back in Europe. Of course, uncertainty relating, you know, to policy settings, but then, of course, also, you know, during the recent crisis. What we also see is that there has been a shift from traditional investments in typical machinery and equipment towards more intangible assets, data, software, these kind of things, and that this has also been a driver, you know, of this decline in investment, because it's more difficult, say for smaller companies, for instance, to do this kind of investment, to get the financing for these kind of investments in intangible assets. That's also one reason why we think there has been this weakness in investment.
So what I'm hearing you say there is that it's a combination of the fact that there has been a lot of uncertainty, but on the other hand, it's also it's harder to measure perhaps as well, if money is not going to physical capital, but more into intangibles, digital services, etc. Isabel, I could talk to you for a lot longer about this report, because it's a really rich read, and we really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us. Isabel Kosk, the Deputy Director of Country Studies with the OECD Economics Department. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, as record numbers sit the state exams this week, we are asking, are we prepping our business and economic students adequately for the changing work landscape? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk, and I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Well, this week is the first time we've seen more than 140,000 leaving and junior cert students begin the state exams, and the economics exam will take place on Friday the 20th of June. sitting at the tail end of this year's exam timetable. Now, the subject remains an extremely popular choice for students, but is the curriculum, both in school and in college, adequate in preparing graduates for the world of work, and particularly when it comes to navigating the likes of AI and geopolitical turmoil? Now, for listeners who may not be aware, I have a particular interest in this, as I've co-authored the Leaving Cert Economics textbook three times since 2012. And so to dig into this a little bit deeper, I'm joined by Sinead Gogan, Chief People Officer with Deloitte. You're very welcome to Taking Stock, Sinead.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm in awe of your credentials around economics with the Leaving Cert.
Well, thank you very much now. But being the CPO of a global company, I think that that ship sails in two directions. First off, I am going to take a look at your Gen Z and Millennial survey, because it shows, Sinead, that half are already using Gen AI when it comes to how they do the work before they even get to you. So they can't use ChatGPT in the exam. So how well do you think Ireland's current education system prepares young people for the realities of the modern workplace?
Yeah, it's a great question. And yes, our Gen AI and Millennial survey has been going now for about 14 years. So usually has some great insights when it comes out every year. And as you said, this year, a lot of insight around Gen AI and how that's being used by students in work. I think as you bridge into the workplace, there is a lot of challenge with that for employers, particularly for the likes of ourselves with client data, where you have to be really careful with how you use those tools. And often they're, you know, having to be done in different ways or in containers. But how students actually, you know, prepare for that in college. Every year we would spend a lot of time on campus, a lot of time with faculty. Deloitte is probably one of the biggest employers of graduates on the island of Ireland. And that curriculum point is something that we spend a lot of time talking to professors about, and really getting students to build out their skills around how they problem solve, how they articulate things, how they communicate, how they work across multi-location and multidisciplinary teams. Ireland is a phenomenal place to be a graduate, given that we sit between the US and Asia. So you get a lot of large companies here. So you have to straddle, you know, different time zones and work across different ways and work very digitally. So I think universities have it top of mind and are looking at how they do project work, how they have labs, how they bring in clients like ourselves. We've partnered with a couple of universities around bringing in our best managed companies curriculum, which is very real and very much looking at how companies work in the real world and bringing that and threading it in through their curriculums.
So if we really delve into the curricula now, because yeah, I know every line of it a few times, and there's about 4,500 students studying economics for Leaving Cert, according to the CSO. Now, if we take a look at the major issues today around the world, and particularly as well, Sinead, bearing in mind, as you said, what's going on in different parts of the world as well, globalisation, tariffs, changes in the labour market, sustainability, inequality, all that's in there. All that's in the Leaving Cert economics at the moment. So how would you assess the business and the economic syllabus in terms of its relevance to today's business environment, the content itself?
Yeah. In some ways, I sometimes feel like the content itself is, you know, not irrelevant would be the wrong word to use, but how you help students use that to master complexity and how you build out the skills that they're going to need, particularly around resilience. We've got, you know, change coming at us exponentially. Nobody needs me to highlight what's going on in the world, but how you deal with that change management and how you have the right core skills and the right leadership, communication, teamwork. Nobody has the answer themselves today. And it's working together and bringing together, you know, teams and perspectives and people who have the right emotional intelligence is, to me, the currency of the future that students are really going to need to bring into the workplace. So the curriculum is how you build those skills through a lot of practical work, through case studies, you know, group work lectures, and then you're strengthening the kind of capabilities and competencies that they're bringing into the workplace.
Now, you mentioned group and you mentioned teamwork there a little bit before that. And I know in companies like yours, there's such a big emphasis on that.
Yeah.
But yet it's not embedded into the school experience at all. And I would say to the vast, certainly in my own course, I did financial maths and economics in the University of Galway. There was very, very, very little teamwork there. And OK, if we look at where does somebody learn how to be part of a team before they might work in a graduate programme, it does feature in to varying degrees in transition year. the Growing Up in Ireland study notes that a third of young people participate in team sports at 17. I thought it would have been higher. And yet everybody this week sitting to do the leaving and the junior cert are doing an individual exam. Mm. So what's your experience of the teamwork skill by young people as they come into the workplace? Are they equipped with that skill?
Yeah, I think that's something that we certainly would talk to faculty and to schools about. But I think if you turn that on its head, of course it needs to improve. Of course it needs to get better. And actually, we do a lot of work ourselves at the University of Galway and bringing our people in. And I think there is a huge role for business in this environment. And in Ireland, you know, we tend to have a lot of collaboration and partnership because it's very accessible, you know, to get into universities, to access, you know, social policy and the political system and to actually, you know, try and help influence that and navigate that. But I think business have to absolutely dial that up and really help and support and provide the resources and provide the guest lectures and provide the real life case studies and the, you know, the curriculum bills, the labs, the group work support and maybe even bringing, you know, students into workplaces to actually do and practice that. And it's interesting, I think you see actually quite a bit of it grassroots as well with students. We would work a lot with societies and some of them now are actually across universities. There's a really strong one with the consulting society and bringing students, actually bringing, you know, companies and employers in and helping us, you know, influence and help change and bring in those skills that we really need for the future.
So certainly the societies in college when I was there were very influential in the very early part of my career, I would say. And they also add a whole other layer to your college experience for sure.
Yeah.
So do you see that as another contact point almost with universities, rather than it simply being the departments, the faculties, the academics, is that it's the student body themselves through that method?
Absolutely, absolutely. And increasingly, the kind of way that we hire is earlier, the way that we connect with students is earlier in that life cycle. So internships, like we just started last week with over 200 summer interns coming into our business. We're doing that now with first years, with second years, with third years. And then we're hoping that by the time they finish some of those work placements, and some of the universities offer co-ops, which would be, you know, 9 to 12 months in some cases, but they're coming in, they're experiencing the workplace, they're seeing what the work is about, they're seeing how we engage with clients, they're getting really practical skills. And then for us, it's also a great way of knowing that they're interested in the things that we do. And then if we have that connection with them over, you know, the years that they're in college, when they start with us, they're hitting the ground running at a much quicker pace than before.
Well, I think that message is really getting across to younger people, the fact that they need to engage with companies like yours at an earlier stage. I work a lot with teenagers, which we'll talk about on another occasion. But certainly there is a growing awareness that you don't just start with the middle ground or when you finish college in general. We've talked a lot, though, about school. And we've talked a lot about traditional methods of, we'll say, third level education. I do want to now move to alternative paths, because there's been an 11% rise in students opting for the Leaving Cert Applied programme. And as always at this time of the year, like, the airwaves will be full of people talking about there's lots of different career options out there, etc. How are you at Deloitte preparing to bring people in who don't take a traditional academic path? Or are you preparing for that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that our team is really focused on. We have a very big commitment to social impact and how you do that and how you actually thread it through the things that you're really good at is something that's really important to us. So to make that real, we obviously, you know, hire a lot of people with experience, and then we hire a lot of people from campus every year. And then we're trying to look at those pipelines and intakes, making sure firstly that they're diversified, but also that we have alternative paths. So returnships particularly impact women who've been out of the workforce, but it can be men certainly as well. And how we actually bridge them back through support and coaching and, you know, 6 month of placement as they figure out, you know, how they step back in. We have a big focus on internships for development perspectives for those who are in direct provision. And then as we look through all of our work and intakes, we want to make sure that we have a connection back to access programs in universities. So we're not screening people out based on, you know, legacy things like Leaving Cert points, particularly where they've been really successful at actually getting into university through access programs, and then right back to our school programs. So we would have a target for DESH participation in our TY. And I think that's incumbent on all of us. And some of the research last week was just phenomenal, showing that we are now, I think, one of the most, if not the most educated country in the world. And that, you know, how you bring through education that opportunity and that opportunity for people to step up and provide for their livelihood and have the right kind of support to actually access the phenomenal jobs that are available in this marketplace now.
Right. There's a lot you've said there and a couple of things that I want to delve into. One is the point that you mentioned about women. You said about returnships, etc.
Yeah.
And when I looked at the numbers of students who are studying business in Leaving Cert, there's 16,000 students are studying business studies. It used to be BizOrg back in the day.
Yeah,
and that's actually weighted. That's actually weighted towards girls for a start. And the second thing that I wanted to ask you about there is what you mentioned about access legacy issues, like you mentioned about Leaving Cert points, etc. Yeah. And the business studies experience in school, it's classroom based, it's supported by textbooks, it's assessed now with a project worth 40% and a final exam. What do you think of the assessment method? You've spoken about the skills people develop and we've spoken about the content, but what do you think of the assessment method?
Yeah. I think there's going to be a very big inflection point here with what's coming, you know, from an AI perspective and how that actually happens. And I know there's a lot of consultations the department have out around how they want to modernise some of those assessments and curricula. And I know from our conversations with faculty in university and on campus that that's something that they're, you know, very focused on now, because the impact of AI on assessment is going to be huge. But the modernisation of the curriculum, I think the Chartered Accountants body in Ireland has done a lot of work and policy papers on that. Like, I think basically that curriculum from an accountancy perspective for the Leaving Cert hasn't changed since 1976 or something like that.
I did it myself for
Leaving Cert. How that impacts the kinds of students that are then, you know, available to the likes of us, obviously, as, you know, a very large employer of that kind of talent is huge. So there's, you know, without question, there's an awful lot of work that needs to be done on that curriculum.
As we come to the end of our conversation, Sinead, I do have to ask you one question on behalf of teachers, because I hear this sometimes and it's a tricky one, but it's important that I bring this up. I've spoken to teachers who say they've enough to do in preparing teenagers for exams, keep up with curriculum changes, navigate classroom dynamics and handle all the other things going on in workplaces. It's not their job to get students ready for the workplace as well. What do you say to that?
So I would definitely empathise with, you know, teachers and the kind of complexity that they face today. And I'm a mum to two boys, so I absolutely get that. I think, though, we have to step back from that, and I think we have to look at what we have done in this country and the huge and phenomenal success that education has been for Ireland Inc. And, you know, there's a part that, you know, many things have played to feed into that. The workplace and how we have, you know, graduates that are ready to take up the kind of jobs that exist in this economy, we have done really, really well. And that research that I mentioned earlier, I think, points to that. And it's incumbent on all of us, you know, working with teachers, with faculty, with university, with government, you know, and at the social policy level. And I think in a lot of the complexity that we see now in the world and the world of work and what that means and what that means for the future of Ireland, employers have a bigger role to play without question. And I think the way that we do things in this country with a lot of collaboration, with a lot of discussion and debate, and because we're at a scale where you can actually have those connections much easier, we're really well placed to do that. And I would always start from the place of look at what we have already achieved.
Well, Sinead Gogan, Chief People Officer with Deloitte, it's been fascinating to talk to you, and we could continue this conversation long, long, long into the future. Thanks so much indeed for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we'll delve into why Ireland has the lowest rate of employment for people with disabilities in the EU and what supports are not being availed of that exist already that could really help with this. Welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk, and I'm Susan Hayes-Culleton. Well, recently Elaine Teague told me that Ireland has the lowest rate of employment for people with disabilities in the EU, and I was really surprised by that. And specifically, the disability employment rate in Ireland currently stands at 32.6%, significantly lower than the EU average of 51.3%. So why is this? And in a country of almost full employment, why are we not employing more people with a disability to fill crucial skills gaps in the market? So joining me now to discuss this further is the woman herself, Elaine Teague, who is CEO of Disability Federation of Ireland, as well as Bobby Hickey, who works in the diversity and inclusion space, who is fully blind and is joining us to tell us her story as well. So first of all, Elaine, like I said, I think that that is a really shocking figure. Why do you think that is the case in Ireland today?
Well, hello, Susan, and thanks for the opportunity to come and talk to you about it today. So as this is a business show, I think we might just think a little bit about employers and how they might support disabled people into the workplace. So as you said, Ireland ranks last in Europe in terms of the number of people who are working full time who have a disability. And Ireland is at full employment. So why is that? I think that's a really reasonable question. And I suppose there is no one size fits all answer to that. So there are some disabled people who are not able to work or not able to work full time. There are some disabled people who leave the workforce because something happens. Maybe they have a new diagnosis or experience some symptoms and they leave the workforce. Or for many disabled people, there's fear of losing some of the social protection supports like medical cards or disability allowance or free travel. But really, some of the barriers can also be structural. So there's kind of personal experiences that people have. There's structural barriers like maybe somebody can't get into the workplace because it's not accessible or there's no transport available or they can't get housing close by. And then there's employers who might be nervous of taking on a person with a disability. They might be concerned that it might go wrong and they won't know what to do. And in our experience, one of the key barriers is that employers sometimes think it's complicated or costly to employ somebody with a disability. But the reality is that there are many supports out there for employers, but just sometimes they're not widely known.
And I definitely want to get into those, Elaine. And before I do, can I go to you, Bobby? Will you tell us your experience of what it has been like to seek employment?
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me. I suppose I've been pretty lucky in where I've landed in my various forms of employment. But I know that there are a lot of people who, if they do get employment, they won't disclose. They'll choose not to disclose. I know people who have worked in various roles for 6 to 9 months and not disclose disability until they are left with no choice. And this is done out of fear of not getting the job, because if a disability is disclosed for whatever reason in the application form or maybe over the phone before the interview begins, there is a fear out there that they'll be denied the opportunity to interview, let alone get the job. Because there is a lot of stigma and there is a lot of fear because of the systems and because of the lack of education and awareness in this country. There is a lot of fear surrounding disabilities and particularly employing people with disabilities, because to Elaine's point, there is not a lot of understanding of the supports that are there for employers. And a lot of employers think that it's expensive, it's cumbersome, they're not going to be able to do a full day's work. But actually, people with disabilities, we're not a charity case. We are people who want to do a full and honest day's work, dedicated, skilled, talented workers.
When you say about not disclosing disabilities, I would imagine, though, Bobby, that there are certain disabilities that you couldn't not. And therefore, does that mean that, I suppose I'm trying to find the right words here, but does that mean that people are holding back their true selves then when they apply for this because basically the labour market isn't as welcoming to them as others?
Absolutely. There are certain disabilities where you have no choice but to disclose. And there are also certain jobs where, through no fault of your own and before you even, you know, try to apply, you might be out of the running for that job because of whatever disability you have, if it's the nature of the industry. So sometimes there is no choice. And then that's up to the individual. If it looks like there's no choice but to disclose your disability, and if that's not something the individual wants to do or feels comfortable doing, then yeah, they probably would take themselves out of the running on their own accord. And I have been in situations myself where I've disclosed a disability knowing that on the application form it states, you know, you need to be able to drive for this role. Even if it's an office job, I need to be able to have a full driver's license. If I disclose that I'm blind on the application form, then that kind of goes against the driver license point. So it goes on both sides. How seriously are they taking the driver's license, and how seriously do I want to say that I can drive and that I'm not visually impaired and then drop that bomb when I'm in the interview? It depends on how the individual wants to handle it, and it depends on if the employer then wants to say, actually, okay, they can't drive, but let's give them an opportunity because they look like they're ticking every other box here.
Well, Elaine, I think it's important that we do certainly hear just what those supports are as we, to make sure that we get to the root of what we want to talk about here today. What are those supports available to employers?
So there's a range of supports, and I think Bobby has really outlined there that it really depends on each individual, what they need, what kind of supports that they need. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to this, but there is a really great website called Employers for Change. And that is funded by the government, and it provides advice, legal guidance, training. There's lots of resources on that website. And so anything that I talk about now will be referenced on that website. So Employers for Change website, that's really a key resource for anybody who's looking to employ in this job market, and, you know, can maybe consider what's available to them as employers. So the first one is there's a wage subsidy scheme. And so there's up to €12,700 per disabled employee per year available to employers. And this week, Taoiseach Micheál Martin just announced an update to that scheme. So it's now even more inclusive and takes account of more disabled people. But it's interesting that the scheme isn't already widely availed of, probably because it's not very well known. And we find that on occasion, it's up to the disabled person who applies for a job to make sure that the employer is aware of this scheme. So we're definitely pushing for more targeted advertising and communication so that employers know that they can access this scheme. €12,700 per employee per year is not a small amount of money. And then there's also a program called Work and Access, which was formerly called Reasonable Accommodations. And this is where the disabled person who requires an accommodation to support them in their job can get a grant to cover the cost of that. So there could be an adjustment, like they might need to have a ramp installed, or they might need to convert a bathroom to a wheelchair accessible bathroom, or technical supports, or maybe some hardware equipment. And it's worth noting that while that reasonable accommodations fund is there, in Ireland, we know that up to 60% of reasonable accommodations cost nothing. And they're about flex. Sorry.
Sorry, Elaine, we're right up against the clock on this. It sounds like there's lots more that people could hear about on this case. So I definitely would encourage people to go and have a look at those resources. I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Elaine Teague, CEO of Disability Federation of Ireland, and Bobby Hickey, thank you also for coming on the show and telling us your story. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks
so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I really hope you enjoyed the show, and hopefully that you learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, we'd love to hear from you, so please do let us know what your thoughts were on what we talked about this week at takingstock@newstalk.com. And also, if you think others would be interested in the podcast of this, please do forward on the link to them in your WhatsApp groups as well. So I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings here on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And wherever you do go, make sure to subscribe to Taking Stock while you're there. It's also on radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. And the producer of Taking Stock is Kathleen Keane, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Niamh Kinsella. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. And I look forward to chatting to you next week.
Imagine what's possible in your business career when learning doesn't get in the way of life. At Capella University, our game-changing FlexPath learning format is available in select business programs and lets you learn at a time and pace that works for you. That means you don't have to put your life on hold while earning your business degree. Instead, enjoy learning your way and earn your degree without missing a beat. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.